KPCW News Time is now 8:06. You're listening to the local news hour. This is Roger Goldman. Let's find out what's in store for our weather this holiday weekend. We have a report from Cedric Haynes with the ABC4 Weather Center.
Good morning, KPCW listeners. It's Friday morning. Time for a look at your forecast for the Wasatch Back. We're going to be looking at plenty of sunshine as we move throughout today. If you're going to be up in Park City this afternoon, we're looking at high temperatures climbing to around 70 degrees across the area. If you're going to be in the Heber Valley, we're looking at high temperatures in the upper 70s, closing in on the 80-degree mark. Again, a very nice day with temperatures climbing a little above average as we go throughout this afternoon. As we go into your weekend, we are going to be tracking some changes. We've got an upper level low. Oh yeah, it's weatherman's woe. It'll be making its way through the area as we go throughout your Saturday and Sunday. Now, we're not looking at completely bad conditions, but expect a few more clouds to mix in with the sunshine as we go throughout your Saturday and Sunday. And both days, we're going to have a chance of some afternoon pop-up showers developing across the area. I don't think it'll be widespread or an all-day rain event, but there will be some isolated showers developing for both your Saturday and Sunday, especially as you get up towards the Park City area. High temperatures by Sunday will be in the upper 60s in Park City with highs only in the mid 70s for the Heber Valley. But don't worry, just in time for Memorial Day, we'll dry things out and we'll bring back that sunshine, which means we warm those temperatures back up for your Memorial Day. High temperatures expected to climb back into the low 70s for Park City. We'll be seeing those high temperatures climbing to around 80 degrees again for the Heber Valley. As we go into the rest of the week, look for a mixture of sun and clouds out there. We'll call it partly cloudy skies. Highs will be in the low 70s for your Tuesday and Wednesday in Park City. Highs will be in the upper 70s, climbing into the low 80s for us in the Heber Valley as we go towards your Tuesday and Wednesday. So back to more summer-like conditions and temperatures across the area. And we'll stay that way as we get into the middle and latter half of next week with highs in the mid to upper 70s for Park City and highs in the low to mid 80s for the Heber Valley, again, with a mixture of sun and clouds. And overall, warm and dry conditions for your first unofficial week of summer, as we like to say around here. Don't forget that sunscreen with that sun out. SPF 9 or greater as we go throughout the weekend. That's your latest forecast from the ABC Forecast Center. I'm meteorologist Cedric Haynes.
Coming up today, we're going to start by speaking with Cole Nordman of the Utah Olympic Park about their summer activities. Then Carl Hunt from the Utah Division of Forestry will discuss wildfire plans for the summer. Mayor Nanwar will stop by to recap last night's Park City Council meeting. We're going to finish this busy hour by speaking with Janet Conway, an attorney for the landowners opposing the new West Hills Incorporation. Stay tuned. Park City will introduce a new punch pass option for golfers as the season gets into full swing. KPCW's Parker Malatesta has the details.
There are several changes to golf fees for the 2025 season. Along with offering a new season pass to municipal residents, Park City will introduce a five-play punch pass covering five 18-hole rounds or 10 nine-hole rounds. The $300 punch pass will be available to residents within Park City School District boundaries and league association members. The resident rate of $45 for 18 hole rounds is accessible to active military members, veterans, and association golfers. The green fee for non-residents is going up from $70 to $90. Discounted rates for Utah residents are no longer offered. Another change is the discounted city employee pass will now include members of the Park City Fire District. See the full list of golf rate changes online at kpcw.org. The golf course operates as an enterprise fund, which means it needs to break even after operations and build a fund balance to cover capital expenses. Starting in the next budget cycle, the golf course will start to pay for its water usage in full after years of receiving a heavily discounted rate. The total annual charge is estimated around $300,000, and will be phased in over a three-year period, according to a staff report. To ensure long-term financial stability, green fees will increase concurrently over the next 3 years, the report says. Golf course manager Vaughn Robinson said a multi-million-dollar irrigation project will be necessary in the coming years. Park City Municipal is a financial supporter of KPCW. Parker Malatesta, KPCW News.
Well, the recent rain makes for prime weed pulling, and Summit Community Gardens plot owners are back in the garden prepping the soil for planting. As KPCW's Leslie Thatcher reports, while it's warm and sunny now, it'll be almost another month before the freeze date passes and warm weather crops can be planted.
Father's Day is traditionally the time of year that it's safe to plant in the Park City area, and as seasoned growers know, keep the frost cover close by. Helen Nadel, the executive director of Summit Community Gardens and Eats, says a few plots are still available to rent this season. Anyone interested can register online. In the meantime, she says the cool weather crops can go in the ground now.
People have started planting things like peas, radishes, cold weather crops. It's a good time to start getting onions in, some starts. People, it's really active and wonderfully vibrant this year. And, there are a couple weeds, but we're working on that. We're still going to recommend to folks that really, waiting until mid-June for tomatoes.
This year, she says, there'll be a focus on wellness with several free events planned.
We've got a monthly family yoga class that is free. It's on the Saturdays. The first one is coming up June 7th. Then Saturday, July 12th, August 2nd. We're also going to be doing weekly mindful meditation programs in the garden with Mindful Summit County from 9 to 10 every Sunday. So that is a really special, beautiful place to have that connection to nature that we know is linked to increased wellness, mental wellness.
More dinners in the garden are being planned. The first one is June 12th, and a cocktail class is set for Thursday, June 5th for those 21 and older. Volunteers are always needed, from weeding to delivering produce for the food pharmacy program.
We need people to come in and help us keep the space looking beautiful. We know that volunteering is also a wonderful way to connect with other people and to really build mental wellness as well.
Nadel said more than 1,800 students were served during their school year between the after-school programs and camps. Leslie Thatcher, KPCW News.
The Park City School District's athletics master plan has hit a pair of roadblocks. KPCW's Christine Weller reports the Dozier Field layout must be changed and construction start times may be pushed back slightly.
The District Board of Education approved plans for athletic facilities on its Kearns campus in March. The plans involve demolishing Treasure Mountain Junior High and building two soccer fields and eight tennis courts in its place. Turf, softball, and baseball fields will go east of the Treasure lot. Dozier Field will also get a revamp with a new track as well as accessory buildings for concessions and locker rooms. However, Senior Project Manager J.D. Simmons told the board Tuesday the plans have to change. That's because the team discovered a decades-old ordinance that applies to Lucky John Drive, which borders the Dozier Field. It requires a 100-foot buffer between the field and Lucky John.
This did not show up in a title report. This did not show up in any of the parcels. This is also not the first conditional use permit the district has pulled over there. They pulled one for the high school and for Ridge Pole. Never came around.
The Park City Planning Commission also wasn't aware of the ordinance and had approved the project. It learned of the ordinance after a Lucky John resident appealed the decision. Due to the 100-foot buffer requirement, Simmons said the district can't build a two-story concession and team building on the north side of the field. He said the district could try to work with the city to rezone the area or appeal the decision, but that would be a lengthy process, delaying construction for around 7 months. Simmons said the team instead decided to pivot to an east-west design for the building.
We've kicked some designs around. It's not the north building that I liked. I think everybody liked that. You're going to have to remove your bleachers, and the buildings are going to be kind of parched because you just don't have the space that you had in the other configuration.
Construction of the new sports facilities was supposed to be a one-bid package for contractors, but Simmons said it's now been split. The Dozier Field side will be up for approval next month, and construction is expected to start sometime in July. Replacing the field's turf was also taken out of the project. The Treasure Mountain side had a pre-bid meeting Tuesday. Simmons said the team plans to award the bid by the middle of June. That project faces its own hurdle. Park City requires PFAS-free turf be used for the new fields. PER and polyfluorokill chemicals, also called PFAS, are used to resist heat, oil, stains, grease, and water. But scientists say the chemicals are toxic. The Centers for Disease Control link PFAS to developmental, liver, and immune system issues in animals. So Simmons said the turf is being tested and hopes construction can still begin in mid-June. Treasure Mountain is slated for demolition in late September to early October. The board approved $38 million in lease revenue bonds to fund the athletics master plan in December. Christine Weller, KPCW News.
Well, this weekend marks the unofficial beginning of summer. On the phone to tell us about summer activities at the Utah Olympic Park is Kyle Nordman. Good morning, Kyle. Cole Nordman. Good morning, Cole, and thanks for joining us.
Hey, good morning. Thanks for having me.
Okay, so what's going on at the Olympic Park this summer? Let's start with some of what I think you guys have labeled the Big Four.
Yeah, so starting this weekend, we've got our Gold Pass sessions starting up today at 9:30. We also have bobsled sessions that start at 1 o'clock and run till 5. This month, until about June 28th, we run what we call trackside activities. So we've got our alpine slide, extreme zip line, freestyle zip line, extreme tubing, discovery course, and action tower open.
Okay, well, let's sort of explain what some of those are. The zip line, is it a multi-stage zip line? And, you know, how long do you cover on your little wheelie thing? What do you call those things you ride on?
On the extreme zip line, it's about a 1,200-foot long zip line. It starts at the top of the K120 ski jump, and it goes all the way down to the bottom of the landing hill. The freestyle zip line is a little bit shorter. It's kind of our starter zip line. They're both point-to-point zip lines.
And what are the ages for people who could access the zip lines?
Yeah, so those activities are actually more weight-based, so you have to be at least 35 pounds to do those activities. But other than that, as long as you meet that weight requirement, you're good to ride.
Okay, so those are zip lines. Let's talk about extreme tubing. What is that?
Yeah, so that's probably our most exciting activity during the summer besides summer bobsled. That's where we put you on an inner tube, and we push you down the outruns of our K64 and our K90 ski jumping hills. So it's kind of like winter tubing in a way, but you tube down the landing hills that we use in the summertime for training. And when you get up to the 90 and we buff that hill, you go about 50 miles an hour on that inner tube.
And I assume you don't end up jumping, you know, flying off the end like a ski jumper.
No. You're just going down the landing hill. So we push you over the crest, you glide all the way down, and you end up in the outrun where the skiers would in the Olympics or in another event that we would host. So it's a really fun thing to do. You have to be a little older to do that one. If you're a little younger, at least 10 years old, you can do the 64. Mm-hmm. And if you're older than 10, you can actually do the 64 and the 90.
So let's talk about the physics. I have a pretty good understanding about how I slide on snow. Tell me what it is that makes you go on this stuff. What are you sliding on?
Yeah, so we affectionately call it spaghetti grass. It's a specially formulated type of fake turf that they use on ski jumps for the summertime. We wet it down with water, and as soon as we put water on the surface, it actually creates almost the same viscosity as snow. So it allows you to slide fast and go down that hill, like I said, almost 50 miles an hour. So yeah, the physics behind it is we wet it down. It makes that plastic surface very easily slidable, and you slide down just like you were on snow.
Okay. So let me ask about the alpine slide. Tell me about how does that work? Is it a concrete track, and what are you sitting on or riding on?
Yeah, so our alpine slide is actually, it's kind of like an old-school playground slide. So it's all metal all the way down, but it's completely covered in a shade system all the way along it. And you actually drive your own cart. If you're at least 48 inches tall, you can drive your own sled. If not, you can ride with mom or dad all the way down. And you control your speed the entire ride. There's a little lever on the front of the cart where if you push down, you go a little bit faster. If you pull back, that kind of hits the brake a little bit. So it's our most popular activity during the summertime. People love our alpine slide. And it's one that you can definitely do with the whole family.
And I assume you actually do need to use that brake. I remember naively once thinking on the Park City Mountain Resort slide, they would never run the liability risk of letting you fly off the track if you don't push down the brake. And, of course, I flew off the track. So, yes, how many curves are there? Talk a little bit about that slide track.
Yeah, there's about 17 curves throughout the entire track. So it's a long ride. It starts just like the extreme zip line. It starts all the way up by the top of the K120 ski jump and ends all the way down at the bottom of our Nordic chairlift. So you get a lot of turns. You get a lot of great scenery, a lot of opportunities to use that brake or use the gas. during our Gold Pass sessions, you can actually do that activity as many times as you'd like during that 3.5-hour session. So maybe the first time you'll use the brake a little bit more, and then once you get a little more confident, maybe you'll use a little less brake.
And you've mentioned Gold Passes a couple times. Can you explain how that works to our listeners?
Yeah, so each day throughout the summer, we have what we call our Gold Pass session. So you get 3.5 hours from either 9:30 to 1 or 2 to 5:30 to come in and enjoy all the activities that you can within that time frame. You can book all of those online at UtahOlympicLegacy.org. And a couple summers ago, so last summer was our first summer, we introduced dynamic pricing, or what we term plan ahead pricing. So the further ahead you book your tickets, the better price you're going to get. Tickets prices never go down, but it's all based on demand. So you can go through our entire calendar, see weekends that might not be as busy, and you're going to get a better price on that ticket.
We've been talking to Cole Nordman of the Utah Olympic Park, where things are going to be jumping this weekend. Thanks for spending time this weekend with us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
The onset of summer is also the onset of wildfire season. On the phone to discuss the state's plan for the season is Carl Hunt. Good morning, and thanks for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So let's start out with this. I understand that the governor has already declared a state of emergency with respect to wildfires. What does that mean?
So the governor declared a state of emergency related to drought, and we know drought impacts wildfire season. Mm-hmm. And the drought was for the southern part of the state, about 17 counties. That was issued back on April 24th. And that was just to kind of address the below normal snowpack that area of the state had seen. And so, you know, with drought comes drier fuels, and those dry fuels are really easy to ignite. So it is a concern for everybody kind of in the state of what's wildfire season going to look like this year.
And Carl, talk about what the snowpack that would affect us here in Summit and Wasatch counties. Was it significantly below normal in this part of the state as well?
The northern part of the state was at normal.
Okay.
But with drought conditions, it's hard to know what's going to happen. It's pretty unpredictable. But when we look at the southern part of the state, and the reason why that executive order was put out was they were 44% of normal down there. So up here in northern Utah, we fared a little bit better. You know, we got a little bit more wetter weather, some snow. But yeah, it's still a concern.
And so what, you know, how do you plan for a wildfire season? I mean, I guess you look at things like drought, but talk to us a little bit about the planning that your organization goes into to help prepare for the season.
Yeah, so our division, Division of Forestry, Fire, and State Lands, we have a fire warden in every county, and that fire warden works with the local entities there, the local fire departments, the special service districts, to really be prepared and ready for whatever comes this summer. They'll hold engine academies with some of the volunteer departments just to make sure everyone is on the same page and we put forth a really coordinated effort.
Okay, so who are you organizing with? I mean, obviously the local fire departments have a substantial sort of role in dealing with wildfires. Can you explain sort of how that matrix, how you organize to deal with a wildfire?
Yeah, and so we talk about working with the local districts, but we also coordinate with the federal government depending on land jurisdiction. So if it's the Forest Service or the BLM, we even coordinate with National Parks and the Bureau of Indian Affairs. And we really try to focus on an interagency effort and just not leave it to one agency that might have jurisdiction over that land. We like to say the closest resource is the first one that's going to respond. Usually that's the local fire districts, mm-hmm. in the communities, but we really want to get there as soon as we can, try to get, you know, our heads wrapped around it and really attack the fire and keep it low. Over the past couple years, we've had over a 90% catch rate with all of our wildfires, which means we've kept them under 10 acres.
Wow. Okay, so with I want to go back to Southern Utah just for a minute. With those kind of numbers on the snowpack, are you expecting a significant increase in wildfires this summer down south?
We are anticipating a little bit more activity. We've had wet weather the last couple years across the entire state. That's really helped. But when that happens, we get a lot of growth, especially in our fine fuel, so our grasses, cheatgrass, like shrubbery. And then they don't seem to really burn the summers after those wet winters. Mm-hmm. And so that carryover fuel adds extra to the landscape, which increases that fire danger and fire potential.
What are the major causes of wildfires here in Utah?
So one of the major causes of wildfire are humans, us. And right now, we're at about 85% of all wildfires in the state have been caused by humans. And that's about on par with the national average. The national average is anywhere from 8 to 9 out of 10. And so the state 5 years ago, we launched the Fire Sense campaign, which was raising awareness and focusing on what we can do when we're outside enjoying, recreating, doing whatever it is we like to do in Utah, how we have an impact on whether a wildfire starts or not.
Okay, and you know, if listeners want to learn more and get more educated on wildfire prevention, do you guys have resources that they can look to?
Absolutely. UtahFireSense.org is our website for that campaign. It has tips on extinguishing your campfire. If you're going to conduct an agriculture debris burn, steps that might need to be taken to make sure it's done safely. Lighting fireworks around the holiday season, steps we can take to not have them start a wildfire. And then if you're just traveling down the road, there's tips on making sure you reach your destination safely and you don't have to pull over the side of the road, because roadside starts are one of our highest causes of fires here in the state.
That's interesting. Are those things like chains, dragging and creating sparks?
Yeah, chains dragging. They can throw sparks. They can have a hot link of that chain that breaks off and goes into the shrubbery next to the road, which starts a wildfire. We also see exhaust components from like catalytic converters that start, and even worn tires on a trailer. You get a flat tire, that rim can throw some sparks, which can start a wildfire. So it's really important to make sure the vehicles are maintained so that you don't have a roadside incident that you have to stop for and you're able to make your destination safely.
Okay, Carl Hunt, thanks for spending time with us this morning.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Well, joining me in the studio this morning is Park City Mayor Nan Worrell. Morning, Nan.
Happy Friday.
It is a happy Friday. It's a holiday weekend. Should be a lot of fun. But first, we have to talk about the work you guys did last night. I understand you started with a high-level briefing on soil remediation at Richardson Flat. Can you just remind listeners why we need to remediate the soil at Richardson Flat?
Sure. I mean, that was fascinating to me. Mm-hmm. It was, you know, I've heard about all the work that's going on out there in the EPA, but the city has been storing soils that have some contamination in them out there before they're even regulations. So it goes way, way back. And the EPA has been doing an engineering study out there. And so James Howe, who's a remedial project engineer, came and spoke with us last night and just kind of gave us an update. There is about 27 acres that they've been studying. It runs about 6 to 7 miles out in the Richardson Flat area. And so it's not a Superfund site, which kind of surprised me, but it's not. Okay. And because it is not listed as a Superfund site, those funds can't be accessed for the remediation of it.
So does that mean that the remediation costs will fall onto the owner of the land?
EPA has set aside a fund for the remediation, and there's about $17 million in that. It's not enough to do everything.
Yeah.
So James was great last night and talked about, you know, they're going to have to prioritize, you know, where do they think, excuse me, where do they think the most important places are to start with the remediation of it. He did show the aerial photos were fascinating because you could really see where the contamination was, and it's hard to tell from the ground.
And that kind of segues into, you know, how the need for remediation affects the city's planning for future use of the area outside.
Correct.
This is very inarticulate. Is the stuff near the parking lot where I think you might want to go first, stuff that might be subject to remediation early?
You know, he didn't have a pecking order of when things were. One of the things that I thought was very interesting was he had an aerial of the rail trail out in that area, and the amount of contamination along the side of the rail trail is concerning. And he pointed that out, and I think that may be one of the first things that they look at. But now that they've done all of this study and they know where it all is, they're going to have a public comment period. And I asked when that was going to be, and, you know, it's not quite set yet, but probably within the next 2 to 3 months.
So a cleanup like this takes money, obviously. It also takes time.
Yeah.
Was there any timeline he presented as to, you know, how long this remediation would take and when they hope to be done with it?
No.
Not even we'll get it done by the Olympics?
I would hope it would.
Exactly. Yeah. But nothing like that. Okay. Anything else on remediation?
No. It was just fascinating.
You also received a staff report on the Iron Horse Drive Public Works Facility.
Mm-hmm.
What did the reports say about the current sort of function of the facility? Is it still adequate for current use?
Absolutely.
Okay.
And both our public works director, Troy Daly, and Tim Sanderson, our transportation director, were in the meeting with us and talked about it. And right now, it's adequate for what they do. Public utilities moved out now that we have Three Kings completed, so that freed up an entire floor. And there's great utility in having both of them in the same area, so they can share a shop. They
both
can,
public works and
transportation.
Private transportation. Okay,
yeah,
so
transportation in the same facility, just for efficiency. So the mechanics, if we, that we roll a bus in there, they can work on that. If we have a police cruiser go down, they can work on that there. And, so there's a lot of efficiency where we are.
There has been from time to time conversation about possibly moving this out to Gordo, for example. Mm-hmm. Where is there a process for evaluating and make a decision on that? Was that brought up last night?
Sure. There's been a lot of analysis, a lot of study about where possibly those functions could be relocated. And one of the challenges with relocating out to, say, Gordo or even further out towards Richardson Flat is if we need to add more salt to the snowplow, instead of them being able to just go into the core of town to do that, they'd have to go way out and, do the traffic deal and all of that. So, there's a lot of efficiencies. Council did give direction to, really look at Gordo and see if there's a possibility to relocate them out there and what that would take. Would we need a satellite sandbox here in town?
There are those giant piles of sand there. That are pretty noteworthy. Okay, so if you were to move Public Works, would that be a potential site for a City Hall move or something else?
Certainly.
Yeah.
It's a prime piece of property. It's
exactly.
A very valuable piece of property. And, is storing our sand there and having our Public Works there, is that the best use of that? And another issue is all of our buses are in the same place. And from an insurance standpoint, that's tricky because if something were to happen, if one bus were to spark or something like that, we could lose the whole fleet. And so, there is some advantage to having different places to put different parts of the fleet.
That's really interesting. It's kind of like the last bus standing thing, like how do we plan for a potential disaster?
Yeah.
And is that something the insurance companies have nudged the city on? I mean, is that something that they've talked about?
Yes.
Fascinating. Okay. Let's see. Also, I think that you spent a lot of time yesterday.
I did, 7 hours.
And much of that was on potential amendments to the Bonanza Park Code.
Right.
Okay, before we get into that, how does that interplay with the 5-acre parcel?
The code amendments, land management code amendments, are for the entire Bonanza Park area, which includes the five acre sites.
Okay, what were the major sort of variables that were being discussed about a potential code amendment? Why do you need to amend the code at all?
We did the small area plan, and we want to make sure that the land management code supports the adopted plan. And so the Planning Commission has just worked hours on the code amendments, and they came to the council last night. Commissioners Frontero and Johnson were there as well, which was great because it gave us a chance to hear from them directly on why certain things were put the way they did by the Planning Commission. So it came to the council last night to see if there was agreement on the proposed drafted code amendments, and then it'll go back to Planning Commission now that we've given that input, and then on June 26th, I believe, it'll come back to the council.
So let's go down a level and not down three levels, because I'm sure if we went down all the way, the intricacies of what you guys discussed would probably put our listeners to sleep. But well, everybody's getting ready for the holiday weekend. But what are some of the big, changes, big alterations that need to be considered as part of this process? I know one of those height.
Height, definitely. The amount of open space, whether or not to allow nightly rentals, whether or not to allow hotels, or the size of those hotels. Parking certainly was considered. The frontage protection zone has limitations, and so that was considered. And then the amount of affordable housing.
Okay, so if you sort of mandate an affordable housing number, would that affect each potential development parcel, or would it be an affordable housing number that would affect the area as a whole?
Of the parcel that's being developed. So,
okay.
if someone comes in with an application,
okay.
then...
For housing of any kind?
For development of any kind, yeah.
Right.
So if they wanted to redevelop anything over like
the storage units, for example,
Holiday Village, right, or anything, yeah, like that. Yes, then it would be calculated against the total square footage of the entire building.
Are there any parts of the city where you see a 45-foot? I know a 45-foot height was being considered. Would that be the only part of town where you'd see 45-foot high buildings?
You know, that was a question that we kind of talked about to see if we had any taller than that. And we think we're not sure. You know, because it
depends on where ground is?
The topography, right. You know, and so height's measured from the natural grade, but where's natural grade? Anyway.
Okay, so in terms of code, would 45 feet be sort of a new, for lack of a better term, a new high?
Right now, the code allows for three stories, okay, which is about 35 feet.
35, right. So these would be four-story buildings?
They could be, okay, if the developer brings enough community benefit. You know, that's one lever that can be pulled to help.
And when the first pictures were released of the five-acre parcel, not that social media is any barometer of anything other than who's looking at social media, there was a lot of concern that it looked boxy and confined.
Sure.
What was your reaction to that? And what is your reaction to the drawings? I mean, are they close to the vision? Do you think that we can get from here to where the vision you'd like to see implemented will be?
I think we can. And both developers that presented to the public and to the council were very clear in their opening comments that this was conceptual, mm-hmm, you know, and they didn't, you know, go into great architectural detail, but rather did kind of the blocks of this is where this building would go, this is where that building could go. But certainly in the negotiation with a selected developer, that those things will be considered.
Yeah, it did feel a little bit confined and claustrophobic, and I think it might be that you have to wait for further iterations.
Sure.
And I think you guys are going to have to do something like have some VR where people can like pretend to walk through what it looks like for people to get a real sense of what can be done here.
I love that because it lets you see where the shadow's going to be if I want to see where snow's melting and that type of thing. I think it's really important.
Okay, you're not running for re-election.
I am not.
Which, boy, I got a smile out of that. Okay. What are three things that you want to get done before you're done?
I want to get the senior center totally squared away and ready to have the entitlements done on it. And we're moving along really well with that. I'm pleased with that. Certainly the 5-acre site. I want to make sure that we have a plan in place and that it's moving forward. So we've got some heavy lifting to do.
Have we got a third?
Oh, I'm trying to think, I've got so many. Probably I want to make sure that we keep our child care program on track. You know, right now we have a very successful child care scholarship program, and I was encouraged earlier this week. I had a meeting with the people that administer our program, as well as with the chamber and some other folks. There's a possible opportunity for small businesses to participate in the scholarship program as well. So we're vetting that right now, and I just want to make sure that we continue to care for our families.
Okay. Have you started doing any of the activities with respect to the Olympics, or is that something that, given that you're leaving, you will not, I know you're not going to, will you continue to participate in the Olympic Committee?
I will not. You know, one of the things that was really important to me was that Park City has a seat at the table, and we do. And so I have a seat on the steering committee, right, as well as the host communities committee. And so those seats stay with my office. So the next mayor will continue those on. And right now we are in meeting with people that were instrumental with the 2002 games and just say, what were lessons learned? What are the landmines that you would never do again?
Okay, anything else from last night's meeting you want to cover?
No, thank you.
Okay, I understand you're going to be speaking at an event on Memorial Day. Talk a little bit about what Memorial Day means to you and then the ceremony that you'll be speaking at.
Every year, I think it's been 14 years now, there's a ceremony in the cemetery, Park City Cemetery, and, you know, the sheriff's posse is there, there's a color guard, it's very emotional for me, I guess. As a veteran, I'm going to be so emotional about it. As a veteran, Memorial Day is very important to me, and just represents the sacrifice so many people made for our country and continue to make for our country, and the sense of patriotism and the sense of duty to country, I think, really are highlighted that day.
Okay. We've been speaking to Mayor Nan Worrell. Thanks for spending time with us this morning.
Thank you.
A group of landowners have filed suit in an effort to stop the municipal incorporation of West Hills. Here to talk about it is Attorney Janet Conway. Good morning, and thanks for joining us this morning.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, let's do some background. This concept of incorporation, we've heard about it in a couple of instances, but can you just explain what it is?
The municipal incorporation is where you have the ability to form a town or city within an unincorporated area of a county in order to gain local representation and have more of a community-based decisions on land use and going forward with services at a local level.
And how do you think, what kind of circumstances do you think the statute, when it was passed, what kind of circumstances was it intended to address?
Well, the incorporation statute changes almost every year. There are changes. It's constantly evolving. There have been some issues about rights of property owners being able to exclude from pending incorporations, and that issue has changed a lot over the years. And earlier, no one had the right to a notice of exclusion unless you were in a first-class county, which only covered Salt Lake. And then that became a due process rights of notice for those owners, so then they attempted to create these rights for notice and exclusion. But somewhere along the lines, this has then been morphed into this current form that's governing West Hills, that a sponsor, once somebody excludes property from the original map, a sponsor can then go and add new properties, and those owners don't have the rights that the original owners have. And that's where it's running afoul.
And I think that's a central point in the lawsuit. We're going to get there. I want to go back and let's just go through a little bit more of the stages. So I'm a landowner and I live in this area. We want to incorporate. What do I have to do?
So in order to incorporate, you have to prepare a request for feasibility study. And you have to have a certain amount of signatures representing a geographic area of land, a minimum geographic area, and a minimum value. And once you have circulated and obtained enough signatures to submit to the Lieutenant Governor, if you meet those statutory requirements, they then are required to order a feasibility study to determine if a potential city is feasible.
And by feasibility, that it has enough resources to do its public works and things like that?
Absolutely. Okay. It measures the expenses and revenue.
And that was done here, I take it, with respect to West Hills?
Yes, it was.
And was the conclusion of that it was, in fact, feasible?
The consultants did conclude that, yes.
Okay. And then the next step, but for this lawsuit or other things, the next step would be that it would go to a vote of who?
So once the feasibility study is determined positive, mm-hmm. then there's another round of signatures for another petition. So then you have to again determine land value and minimum voters, because you have to have so many residents and voters to meet the requirements. And so then you circulate and gather signatures, and then that's a petition to place the measure onto the ballot.
And that, I take it, has been done at West Hills?
Yes, it has.
And has someone determined that it, in fact, can be placed on the ballot?
Yes, they have.
Okay, so I'm just trying to set the stage for how we get to where we are right now. Okay, now, let's go back and talk about this concept of exclusion. I'm a property owner, and I understand that somebody's going to try to incorporate. What right do I have as a property owner to say, hey, I don't want to be in your town?
Well, certainly the statute provides that if you have a certain amount of land or value, and you're not necessarily relying deeply upon the county to provide services and infrastructure, then you have certain rights to not place your property at risk for some budgeting thing that may or may not succeed.
Okay, so I raise my hand and I say I want out. Does that mean I am no longer included in the district boundaries of this proposed incorporation?
That is correct.
I have the right to say no.
Yes.
Okay. Now, I think, as I understand the complaint, and I am a recovering lawyer, I'm doing the best I can here. As I understand the complaint, a central tenet of the complaint is that people who have that right to opt out in the initial submission, but if the submission is amended under the existing statutory scheme, I don't have that right.
Correct.
So if I wasn't in there in the first place and you stick me in there in the amendment, I can raise my hand and no one cares.
Exactly.
Okay. Why is that okay?
It's not.
Okay. And is that what the lawsuit's about?
Yes, it is.
Okay. Can you explain? Now, let's take it down. So I tried to put it into English. Now put it into fancy, like, legal terms about what the theories of recovery are.
So this concept of notice and rights of a property owner to be included or excluded from a map, the concept is, but most people understand it as an equal protection idea, where if you are in all respects the same as the person next to me, but the law is treating me differently and giving me rights, but not the person next to me those same rights, that is, you're not being equally protected by the law. In Utah, we have a state constitutional provision. It's called Uniform Operation of Laws. That it sounds like equal protection, mm-hmm. but equal protection has evolved and is designed oftentimes to protect minority groups, people that are already being oppressed. Uniform Operation of Laws is more of an even playing field. It's recognizing whether or not you're a minority group, you are situated same as the person next to you, and so therefore you should be treated the same.
And I'm sure that's part of your sort of preparation for a lawsuit of this nature. You sort of went back and looked at legislative history, anything like that. Have any idea why? This seems like an incongruity that I would be allowed to object if I was in the initial, but I'm not allowed to object in the amended. Any idea why the statute, did the statute read like that, or do you think this might have been an unintended consequence, as is often the case?
I'm certainly hopeful it's an unintended consequence. Mm-hmm. I really am hopeful. Beyond that, I can only speculate my suspicions, and that might not be appropriate to share.
We would be interested. But anyway, has the statute been amended subsequent to the one that applied to this particular development?
Yes.
Okay. And what does it read now? Does it read now that someone who is affected by an amended plan would have the right to object?
That's a very good question. I'm not entirely sure how mm-hmm. the exclusion rights. I am aware that they had changed the rules about the minimum number of voters to become a town. And as a result, this particular incorporation petition was submitted while it was waiting for enactment. So he is being governed, this incorporation is being governed by the prior law. It would never have made it to this stage under the
current law. And again, just to put a little flesh on that bone, how many voters are required under the new law, and how many does he have?
My understanding is you're required to have at least 50, mm-hmm. and this has 47.
Okay. All right. So you filed a lawsuit. Lawsuits take a long time. Explain how this interacts with an upcoming November ballot measure.
Well, lawsuits can take a long time, but they can also move fairly quickly as well. So it's our intent to be very aggressive in getting to the merits on this case. We fully intend to try to get a decision before the November election.
And is this the kind of situation where you might file something for like a preliminary injunction request to try to goose the process forward? That's a very lawyer question for you.
It's a very lawyer question, and yes, preliminary injunctions are a tool that could be used. I think that we have enough time to not go to that. That's an extraordinary form of relief, and it's something that I would not do lightly unless I feel that we can't reach the merits before the election.
And have you had any I read the complaint. Has there been a response filed yet? I would imagine not.
No, the response is everybody has accepted service. And the responses are due June 13th.
Okay. Anything else that we should touch on to try to further explain how this process is going to work? I mean, in a case like this, will there be significant discovery? It seems to me the facts are sort of on their face.
The facts are on their face. Okay. It's a legal interpretation as to whether the law as it is written and applied, the facts are not in dispute. And so the court should be able to determine as a matter of law, not as a factual issue.
And looking at this, lawyers always want to know, okay, what's something that looked like this that have been decided in the Utah courts? How have the Utah courts looked at these? What kind of analogies are you looking to say, look, you decided X, therefore this should be decided the same way?
The redistricting lawsuit by mm-hmm. the League of Women Voters is a model. That involves this concept of creating maps that excludes certain people and to determine an outcome of a vote by creating a map in such a way.
And that actually, that goes to what I think is a slightly different issue in this case.
Yes.
Which is, talk a little bit about this funky map that sort of, you know, we see the term gerrymander relates, yes, to a 19th century cartoon which showed congressional districts that looked like a dragon. I'm looking at the map in the complaint. Talk a little bit about the sort of oddities of the way this thing was drawn and how that is a strategic issue that you want to challenge.
Well, I believe that this map is drawn in such a way to have excluded certain owners that the sponsors were aware would be opposed to the incorporation and having that area developed. And so that is how you wind up with these large, what I call peninsulas of unincorporated areas surrounded by these long octopus-type arms that go out of incorporated areas. And those arms that go out were all created in the modified map, bringing in large value and large acreage property owners that did not have a say.
Okay.
And I think that violates freedom of association rights under the Constitution, the ability for people to come together as a community to drive the local representation.
Now, I don't know, I understand that there's been, you've gotten some support or from some of the local county and city governments, and that there's been cease and desist letters fired off. Can you sort of explain what those are? I know you're sort of a third party to this, but.
Yeah, I believe that, you know, the sponsors of the incorporation are concerned that after their efforts that they might not get it on the ballot. Mm-hmm. And so I think they're very upset with anybody that has taken a public statement expressing concerns, whether it's about the incorporation, whether it's about resources, you know, and impacting the environment. And so I just feel that that's just a reaction that he's upset.
Okay. Janet Conway, anything else you want to add on before we go?
No, I think.
Thanks so much for coming in and joining us this morning.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, by the end of next summer, Weseco, Utah must be out of its Woodbine Way location to make way for construction as Park City begins the redevelopment of Bonanza Park and putting nearby power lines underground. What that means for the thousands who visit the center with their recyclables is still up in the air. Leslie Thatcher reports.
Recycle Utah General Manager Jim Bedell says the nonprofit received marching orders from Park City be out of its current location by September 1st of 2026. Bedell says the plan is to close the center on June 30th of next year, giving the organization a few months to remove its equipment and clean up the site.
We've known for decades, you know, from the moment that Recycle Utah moved into the old bus shed owned by Park City Municipal Corporation, that eventually we'd need to leave. The city would need to repurpose that land, and that time has finally come.
However, the organization is frustrated by the lack of a clear interim or long-term plan to handle the 3.5 million pounds of material that it processes every year.
We are somewhat frustrated because at this point there is no answer. You know, more concerning, there's been no decision yet on the longer-term plan. You've heard us speak before, and community members have in other forums, about what we truly need as a community, which is investment in diversion infrastructure to allow us to keep a lot more material out of the landfill. That's the bigger question, is what do we want to do in the long run?
Park City Manager Matt Dias says the city has offered Recycle Utah free rent and utilities for nearly 3 decades, and the facility is now outdated, undersized, and in the middle of a redevelopment site. Dias is optimistic that a better regional facility will happen. Because it's budget season, Councilmember Jeremy Rubel asked council members what kind of financial investment they're willing to support. Before a budget transfer is made, the city's sustainability director will be presenting different options for the council to consider next month. Leslie Thatcher, KPCW News.
You've been listening to the Local News Hour. Coming up in our next hour, the community campfire. Gather around Friday mornings at 9 a.m. This week, meet the Troublemakers, Park City's all-women a cappella group harmonizing hearts and voices since 2012 with music that unites and uplifts. Then discover the story behind Memorial Hill in Midway, a powerful tribute to Heber Valley's veterans, shaped over decades by local hands and hearts. And of course, Coach Skinner will have a high school playoff sports report. The Campfire Kids will share their wisdom, and we have a musical guest, Rick Gerber, who'll drop by for an in-studio performance. All this and more on the Community Campfire coming up right after the NPR News here on KPCW. Monday on Mountain Money, we're going to have a special Memorial Day show. We're going to be joined by Daniel Contreras. He's the National Commander of the Disabled American Veterans. While Memorial Day is technically about those who have died, others have made sacrifices.